Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
Welcome to the Runner's World podcast with me, Rick Pearson.
And me, Ben Hobson.
Today we're talking to Nick Butter, the man who ran a marathon in every country around the world.
Blimey.
Ben, what's the what's the most exotic country you've run in, mate?
Ooh. Well, I've run the most exotic place I've done a race, a proper race, would be Japan.
Ooh, yes, please.
Right, I know, it is good. It was amazing. I did the Red Bull, the Wings for Life race. That's the one where everyone starts at the same time, that one.
That's the one, yeah.
Yep. And I got to go out to Japan for that. I think that the race itself was kind of weird because it was quite rural. So it was like sort of, and it was at night time. So I was in Japan doing an amazing race, but I just had no idea what I was looking at or running past. So it could have really been anywhere, but... it was amazing because there's, you know, obviously we the running culture in Japan is well established and revered. So people were coming out and cheering and late into the night. So it wasn't just a sort of like a sort of weird thing that was happening and people were ignoring. It was a celebrated thing. So that was really good. What about you?
Well, I once visited this place called Sealand, which is a self-declared country just off the east coast of England, so like near Harwich is the port, and
I've never heard of it.
No, a lot of people haven't. And essentially, it was a Second World War II gunning tower, and there's a few of these dotted around the British coast. And I think in the 60s, someone came and claimed it as their own country. It was in an area of a map called Terra Nullis, I think, which means it's kind of owned by no one. So. Theoretically kind of up for grabs. So this chap went there and said, yeah, this is a country, the principality of Sealand. And I had a friend at Herne Hill Harriers, the running club that I'm kind of loosely affiliated with, and a guy called Simon Messenger, and he was doing 70 runs around the world. So he's kind of seeing the world in 70 races, basically. And he came to me and said, look, I really want to go to Sealand. And I was like, wow, I've never heard of it. And I looked up and said, this is amazing. So he wanted to do the first ever half marathon on Sealand, so we convinced a treadmill company to ship a treadmill out to Sealand. You can only get there on a kind of motorboat that they own, the royalty of Sealand, and it got winched up. So, and we went and he did the first ever half marathon on deck of Sealand, and it was amazing. It was an amazing day out. Actually, we created a small film of it called No Half Measures. If anyone wants to Google No Half Measures Sealand, you can see the whole thing. So
I mean all of this is amazing, but do people still live on Sealand? Is it that someone's just home that they live on?
Yeah, there's about a sort of rotating cast of about five or six people who look after it, so there's always someone there, so it's always manned. Had an amazing history. I think in the 70s, I think a group of Germans took Sealand by siege. They actually kidnapped someone who was living in Sealand for a few days, and the people of Sealand got a James Bond pilot of a helicopter and swooped and took it back. I think with, you know, like with force, basically. So it's had,
oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's an incredible history, and they're very, very proud of it, and they really do believe it is its own, you know, it's got a right foot.
Yeah.
There's a Sealand football team. You can become a knight, I think, of Sealand. You can buy kind of, you know, sirs, you know, titles.
Amazing.
So, but it was amazing. Yeah, I mean, it had to be done on a treadmill because it's just too dangerous, really, to run around the deck of it, but it was
amazing. Yeah, like an old gunning tower.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Fine. Mate, well, yours is better than mine.
Well, no, it's bizarre, but yeah, I've got a Sealand stamp in my passport as well, because they stamp your passport as you go in. Yeah. So
amazing.
Pretty cool. Yeah. So I wonder, can our readers beat that, or actually, you know, just tell us where the most exciting place you've been running. Let us know. podcast@runnersworld.co.uk.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
Talking about readers writing in, Ben, we had a response actually to last week's podcast about harassment on the run. So just to recap, if you didn't listen to that one, we spoke with Kat Roberts, who's a runner who's been conducting a number of interviews with women who've been verbally or physically abused while running. It does seem like it's still a big problem and consideration for people. So yeah, Kat spoke about it being a product of kind of lad culture, and sort of women and men need to start, when they see it, start calling it out, basically. We think she was right. And we received an email from a former policeman who was in support of what Kat said, of course, but he had a few kind of safety pointers he wanted to point out. So I thought maybe worth reading these out anyway, just to sort of continue the discussion. So he says, I'm a retired London police officer who, during my service, used to give safety for women presentations, which were given to groups of women who were concerned with their safety on the street. And I'll list some of the advice here. So he says, choose your route. So run routes that you consider safe, well-lit, well-populated, etc. Raise your vision. Keep looking ahead for points or persons that you may consider would cause you issues. Concentrate, so don't get wrapped up in, you know, the music or a podcast you may be listening to, and do not put yourself in danger, which I think was his main point. He said that, you know, if you see you're approaching a situation that is dangerous or somebody who looks dodgy, try to sort of remove yourself from that situation, change your route, etc. And he felt he just felt that needed to be underlined, because I think Kat rightly said that, you know, more people need to call this out, but his concern was that, you know, essentially, if you did, you know, say to someone, look, what you're doing is out of order, or, you know, what on earth are you doing? Well, that's empowering. His kind of argument was there appears to be no form of risk assessment in this, and there's always a chance that the perpetrator may raise the incident from a verbal assault to a physical assault. Sometimes it may be better to extricate yourself from the incident. Remember as many details as you can and report it to the authorities if necessary. So I think generally sort of good practical advice, but I think worth reiterating what Kat said is that actually, you know, the emphasis needs to be on people not doing this rather than people being rather than the victims of this, you know, taking the responsibility.
It's a complete balance between changing the whole culture, which is the most fundamentally important part of it, where these things aren't allowed and aren't seen as viable things that you can do, versus challenging something in an immediate situation which could enhance your chance, you know, you put you at more risk. So I think that's kind of like the difference, isn't it? You know, the greater work is call it out, stamp it out, stop it, educate men that you cannot behave in this way, but at the same time, don't put yourself at an additional risk of attack if you're challenging someone late at night and that sort of situation. I think that's what the former policeman is getting at, which, you know, does make sense for anyone, really.
Yeah, agreed. Yeah, we'd still like to hear from more people about this issue, because I think it is a big problem for women and also for men. So let us know, podcast@runnersworld.co.uk.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
So I want to talk about dubious pieces of running kit that you wear regardless. So I'm going to give you an example. So I thought I'm going to experiment with these, you know, these nose clips that you see some runners wearing, you know, and Sarah Hall wears one, basically. And obviously Sarah Hall, amazing London Marathon performance, and Paula Radcliffe wore one when she set her long-standing world record as well. So I thought, okay, well, I've never tried a nose clip. I feel like they kind of slightly got debunked, you know, around the sort of mid-90s when people like Robbie Fowler and like footballers were wearing nose clips. But they're like, they're £7 or something for 30. So you don't have to, you're not having to invest too heavily in this.
Okay, got it.
And I put one on Saturday. I tell you what, Ben, I ran really well. So I started thinking, oh, you know what, next time I'm in a race, I'm going to put on a nose clip. And it got me thinking, are there these items of clothing that we wear in sport that, although science doesn't necessarily back it up and show that it's got, you know, real gains, like not like those, you know, the carbon plated footwear that we know actually does work. These are kind of like stuff that you wear almost for superstition. And I wondered, mate, if you've got anything that fits into that bracket.
Oh God. The thing is, I think a lot of stuff that modern day running tech kind of adopts or is like bought in is like, it's when you get the sort of thermo regulating, like, oh, wear these shorts because they've got like microfibers which will heat up your, you know, like that sort of stuff that you're a bit dubious. Whereas it's stuff like compression socks.
Yes, now, definitely.
So like compression socks work in terms of recovery.
Mm.
You know, in my understanding, and this can be challenged. I'm more than welcome for people to challenge, but you know. If you take the premise that post-surgery on aeroplanes, medical professionals, you got to wear your compression socks because it helps prevent deep vein thrombosis and, you know, blood flow is improved and all this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, after a big, big, big run, some compression socks or some compression on your legs or something like that and elevating them, all good. Not while you're running, though. That seems completely pointless. So there's this sort of, that sort of stuff where it's slightly dubious. I think it's just been adopted as like, compression socks. Yes, I'm a runner. Okay, watch me go.
I completely agree. And I have worn compression socks a lot. And I think I was sort of left with this decision. I think it was a 2018 London Marathon. And I was one of the pacers. And I thought, well, up until that point, I'd done all my sort of marathons had been done in compression socks. But by 2018, I didn't really think that compression socks were doing anything. These were actually like calf guards, you know. But same thing. I just thought, actually, well, you know what? Like, I haven't got that much evidence about what my marathon running is like without these things. And given that I'm kind of shepherding people around in a time, I better get the bloody compression, you know, calf guards on. And I think, you know, you could argue the same thing with K-tape. And I'm not saying before K-tape start emailing in that it doesn't do anything. But I don't think there's a huge amount of science to back it up. But you see people who are just, you know, taped up before a marathon. But I wonder, actually, if it's making you feel good, maybe that's all right.
No, I think that's it. I think that if someone has a niggle that is not, like, totally going to destroy any chances of their race, then maybe a bit of tape or some support or some compression is exactly what they need to make you feel like you're backed up, that you've got the support that you need to sort of just get through the harder bits that you think it might hurt, it might twinge, blah, blah. But no, you're right. Like squeezing, what is some elastic squeezing my calf muscle going to do that my calf muscle can't do already?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that's what is the tape pulling on my skin? Cause it's the skin that tape goes on. So I understand that, like, you know, you're adding support to that structure to the area of the body, but at the same time, the muscles and the internal and your, what's your man who likes bouncing around?
Oh, your fascia. Fascia.
Your fascia. Yeah, exactly. So your fascia, you know, that stuff's pretty good at doing its job. So I'm with you. I think they're both dubious and both incredibly important to people.
The new ones, these arm warmers, aren't they? That you see, you know, Mo Farah's. He's never about his arm warmers, is he? I think he wears them in bed. Actually, he's always.
Mate, when we went to Monza for breaking two, the test event.
Mm.
That was when they unveiled all of the shoes, and obviously everyone got excited about the shoes. But all the kit that they unveiled then was really interesting because it was all bobbled, and it was all sort of built around the premise that you're disrupting the air flow when you move, so it makes you more aerodynamic. So they had all this, like, they called it like blade something or something, I can't remember, but it was the shorts all had like little fins on them, and the arm sleeves had dimples and stuff, and it kind of comes from science based around time trialing on bikes, where you know that if you or golf balls, where you put dimples in a golf ball and it makes it more, you know, it makes it fly through the air better. It's that kind of, like, you're disrupting the air. So they had all this stuff, and I guess when you're doing or aiming to do a sub-2 marathon, every small thing is completely, but that feeds down into general. I mean, me putting on some arm warmers that have got like aerodynamically enhanced bobbles is going to make no difference.
No, you're right. But I think when we're worried or when we're trying to get the most from ourselves, it's so much easier, isn't it, to put your faith in kit, isn't it? Than actually, like, what's your training been like, you know?
Oh yeah, I haven't done any training, but I've got my lucky hat on.
I've got the nose strip again. So, but yeah, I would be really, really interested to know what our listeners think. So I do think that sports like running do lend themselves to little superstitious kind of routines or items of kit. So let us know, what's your dubious piece of kit that you wear regardless? Podcast at runnersworld.co.uk.
Guest of the week. Here in the studio. Guest of the week. Sometimes on the phone. Could be an athlete. Could be a physio. Or a complete unknown.
Our guest this week is a runner and adventurer who last year became the first person to run a marathon in every country around the world. Nick Butter has distilled some of the experience and lessons learned into a new book, Running the World, which is out now. He's here to speak with us about the highs, lows and lessons learned from running a marathon in 196 different countries. So, Nick, welcome to the Runner's World podcast.
Thank you very much for having me on.
We have to start, Nick, with why did you decide to attempt this audacious challenge?
Yeah, good question. I think there's a combination of lots of reasons why it ended up happening, which is very much the way I look at it. I was inspired by this brilliant chap called Kev. And if anybody has ever followed me before, I speak quite a lot about Kevin. I was running back in 2015. I was running the Marathon du Sahara race out in the Sahara Desert. 7 days, grueling race. You're in tent mates with eight or so people, hundreds of tents of people. And you suffer through this scorching heat of the desert together. And one of those people was this guy called Kevin. And he was diagnosed with terminal prostate cancer, and he revealed this to me during the run, and we chatted. And what struck me so obviously with him was that he had this weird disconnect between him being so happy, and yet he was telling me he was dying and potentially only had as little as 2 years to live. And it just, you know, just kind of this didn't chime with me. And I thought, actually, what is it? And I realized that it was his incredible way of dealing with everything and just going head on into life. And he just realized the value of how lucky we have it when, you know, when things like aren't like that happening. And he understands, you know, how much he needs to use his time before his time is up. And I think that can go the same for everybody. And, you know, to cut a long story short, then there was lots of talking, lots of thinking, and I wanted to do something for to fight prostate cancer, to raise some money for him and people in his situation. And so Prostate Cancer UK is the principal charity in the country. And I set a target of £250,000. And then I decided what I was going to do. And that was, you know, he said to me, look, just go out. Don't wait for a diagnosis. Those were his really key words with me. Let this conversation be that. And it really was. You know, I've always been edging towards doing something that was a bit nuts. But I Googled it and I realized it had never been done before. And I, at the time, I couldn't believe that it hadn't been done. You know, we put people on the moon. And so as soon as I settled on it, that was it, really. And then 2 years passed of a lot of quite difficult planning, trying to find funding and, to fix on that number and all sorts of stuff and lots of post-its and maps and conversations. And then, yeah, January the 6th of 2018, I hit the start line and we got going. And the whole, you know, the reality of the situation is by the time I was due to start that, you know, the adventure, is that Kev was potentially, his time was already up according to the diagnosis. And amazingly, you know, he not only lived to see me start, but he also lived to see me finish and is still alive. He is sadly, very sadly, still going to die of prostate cancer. Because it is, you know, he's riddled with it, and as are many people with prostate cancer. But he was, yeah, he's this huge inspiration. So that, you know, the desert, meeting Kev, then, you know, fixing on that trip, and yeah, there we go. The rest is history, as they say.
No, it's incredible. I think it's incredible that you managed to turn it from an idea. I would almost term it a kind of pub idea that you have after a certain amount of pints and you talk about. But you actually made it happen. I think the logistics around organising a trip like this must be just mind-boggling.
Oh, yeah. The logistics were by far the most difficult piece. I think runners and good runners, or not even good runners, just runners that have run a lot. Runners that have run a lot, not necessarily do it well or fast, but any runners know that running, you know, a marathon every few days in a different country, yes, that's going to be taxing. But then you have the extra level of complexities with the political volatility of countries. We had 90 or so flights that were cancelled. And again, put it into context, we planned this route and we thought it could have cost about $100,000 to get the trip done, and we thought we'd be taking about 220 flights. It ended up costing us a hell of a lot more, and we took over double the amount of flights, 455 flights in the end. Gives you an idea of how much, you know, it took 2 years to plan because there was so much that we just couldn't anticipate. But yeah, it was. I'm very proud of the logistical side because I was quite well connected with my mum and dad, and my dad was, bless him, he took it. Well, I say I took it upon him. He didn't take it upon him at all. I volunteered him to do a lot of the logistics work, and then we slowly built a team up around us. And like you say, we made it happen. But you're absolutely right. It was that kind of pub idea, except it was in my own head for a few weeks. And the more I thought about it, the more I just thought this has to be done.
How much money did you end up raising for prostate cancer in the end?
So we got just over, well, I think we're still raising money because fortunately we send our newsletters out, and with this kind of bit of press, we hopefully, you know, the Just Giving page is still live. We've just got over 200, I think it's 200 and something, £203,000.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm pretty pleased with that.
Yeah, that is it. And you did kind of a lot of carbon offsetting as well, didn't you, to sort of offset the flying element, is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. We're actually speaking with a few companies now. It's something that I'm glad you brought that up, because it's something that through my future projects we are focusing very heavily on. Also the kind of educational side of the environmental stuff. But you're absolutely right, we offset 100%, if not more, of the carbon that I was emitting through air travel. And you know, you fill in these questionnaires with the companies that were offsetting it, and they go into detail of, you know, am I a meat eater, am I traveling by train, by car, all that sort of stuff. And they managed to create this lovely map of what your carbon footprint will be, and then they add a little bit on to make sure. So we fortunately ended up offsetting it, and that was through projects. Offsetting is something that I think the general public, including myself at the time, were, you know, look at in a sense of not really understanding how that worked. Do you plant a tree for every mile you'd fly in the air? And effectively, yes, the answer is you could do that, but there are far better ways of doing it. So my particular offset, there was four different projects that we had around the world. A couple in Kenya, one in Mongolia, and one in Guatemala. And things that they do there is stuff like reducing the amount of fuel needed to heat a fire in a yurt, which then ultimately, if you burn less wood, you also saving more trees, but you're also reducing the amount of smoke that the people in these yurts, that are living in the yurts, are inhaling, and therefore the health is improved. And so there's this huge map, and I mean, David Attenborough in his latest book actually talks very eloquently about the benefits and the huge exponential benefits of carbon offsetting. And so yeah, I've got very into it since learning about that. But yeah, I'm lucky actually that a company managed to take me under my wing and help me with that.
Well, I want to get into the nitty-gritty, Nick, of I understand from, I looked at some of the statistics from your adventure, and one of the ones that jumped out was that you were robbed or mugged at gunpoint at one point. So tell us about that.
Yeah, that was I speak about that quite a lot, and every time it's still a bit, sends shivers up my spine, really. Obviously you don't expect it, but running through every country, there's part of me that expects some form of trouble. After I finished running my marathon, and I was walking through the streets of Lagos, the big open air market, one of the biggest, if not the biggest, open air market in the world, through the centre of Nigeria. During my time weaving through these streets, I was actually arm in arm with a couple of people that were there to A, show me around, and B, protect me. And even so, I was set upon by this group of, I would say, between 5 and 8, but it grew to a big bunch of people that were initially just trying to grab things off me, like my camera. And then it started kicking, and then there was starting to kind of fists flailing. And then, you know, that's when the weapons started to be much more apparent and very much in my face. There was one handgun, but most of them were just big, you know, semi-automatic weapons, and things like machetes and knives and swords. But the thing is, you know, I'd seen those lots of other places, so that wasn't particularly scary at that point. You know, when you're then kicked, and I had even some cracked ribs as a result, it was pretty, I mean, not violent in terms of the very violent attacks that can happen, but violent in the sense that I hadn't experienced it before. Fortunately, this group of people that I was with, they managed to kind of shield me a bit as I was in a ball on the floor. genuinely absolutely terrified. And I've always thought that if I get into that situation, I'll just run because that's what I do. But anyone that's ever been to Lagos market, there's no chance you can run anywhere quickly because you just fall over straight away from the mud, from the people, from the stray goats or chickens or cars. You know, there's no way you can get out. And so fortunately, we ended up paying these guys off with as much as we had on us to let us go. But I was very lucky to experience it and get out of it. But I also then had a lot of other countries, especially in that part of the world, that I was then fearful of, looking over my shoulder every 5 minutes. So yeah, it was shocking, but I got away with it, and there wasn't any, other than some bruises and some scrapes and some rib damage, I was all right.
Well, let's talk about some more positive memories. And if you had to pick your favourite, say your favourite marathon out of the 196, what one would it be?
There's an awful lot to choose from. I've got favourite countries, I've got favourite cities, favourite people I ran with. Whether I'd be the times when I went, after a run and I went, whale watching, or whether I, stumbled upon a cheetah in Namibia. I ran around erupting volcanoes in Guatemala and sat on the lip of a volcano in Nicaragua. All of this sort of stuff. And that was actually mid-run. So they were quite good. But I would say a couple that stand out are Nepal and Sierra Leone. Nepal obviously is a beautiful place, as I call it, the crumple zone of the world, where all these mountains come together, and the culture is very different and the people are extraordinarily friendly. So I had a brilliant time there with a very good bunch of people who I still have their WhatsApp numbers for now, and we keep in touch. And in Sierra Leone, that was the once and is still one of the poorest countries in the world, where people live on less than a dollar a day, and I experienced some kindness that I will probably never experience again to that extent. The amount of people that supported me, gave me water that they didn't have enough water for themselves. Just kids that had nothing that were elated just to have a selfie with me. So there is an awful lot. I don't, the book that, is now coming out, the amount of stuff that I want to cram into that book, you can't write about everything, but touching the surface on all of them has been, it's been nice to remember them. And like you say, all of the highs absolutely outweigh the lows.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
I wondered, what do you think you found out about yourself and perhaps the world in general through doing a challenge like this? Because obviously you've now seen more of the world than, 99.9% of people will get the chance to.
So number one, and it's the message that I now preach about in all my school talks and when I speak in businesses or in the theatres that we're speaking next year when they all reopen again. The general message that I talk about is exactly that. And it's the feeling of being outrageously privileged and us not realising it. you know, the amount of people out there, and I use the number, which is there's 2 million children every year that die under the age of 5 years old because they haven't got enough food. But this is one thing that we can change. And the stuff that I saw in myself is that I had a moment of crisis a few times where I thought, am I just being this spoilt runner that's been privileged enough to do this? Shall I just stop and, you know, do everything I possibly can to help everybody that I'm meeting? I was very torn many times, you know, moved to tears when I was visiting hospitals or cancer rehabilitation centres or kids' hospitals. And again, emotional just thinking about it. The amount of people that are in need and we take for granted and we moan about things, you know, we're British, we're always going to moan about the weather. We have it pretty damn well, even when you just consider the weather. And, you know, the clothes on our back, the amount of opportunities and freedom that we have, which people don't often have elsewhere in the world. I really hope that the rest of the world catches up and not catches up with me, but catches up with the understanding of the rest of the world, in the sense that we have an awful lot of responsibility to support other nations and other communities. And also to take some lessons from them.
Yeah, it sounds like you've kind of been forever changed by the challenge, which I think is actually quite unsurprising given that, you know, the scale of what you did. Yeah. Where can people go, Nick, to find out more about, I guess, your next challenges and also the Running the World book?
Yeah, thank you. So the easiest way to find out about what's going on is two things. Instagram, which is Nick Butter Run, or my website, which is very simply nickbutter.com. And on there, you've got my email address, my phone number's on there too. Just reach out if you want to come and run with me at any point. As I said, I'm based in the van. We're actually running north to south of Italy at the moment. And in future, next year, we have the speaking tour going on in 2021 in various schools and theatres around the country. Plus, we have 3 or 4 pretty good, exciting expeditions. We're going to run north to south of New Zealand. We're going to circumnavigate Iceland. We're going to run north to south of Malawi. Basically, just have a lot of fun running. And
God, that sounds all right, Nick, doesn't it? That sounds all right, yeah.
Does sound all right. As I hinted at earlier, a lot of it is going to be to support some institutions around the environmental world, and we're kind of just testing the water with some of that, but with some exciting stuff coming in later years. But I'll leave that for another conversation.
That's great. Well, Nick, look, thank you so much for your time in speaking to us on the Runner's World podcast. I think incredibly inspiring what you've done. I'm very envious, actually, of some of the countries you've visited.
I'm very grateful to have me on, and I think, if, like I said, if anyone wants to get in touch, then please do. And obviously, a last plug of the book, which has taken me a good year to finish writing. It's called Running the World. It's on Amazon now on discount, actually. And it's just a lot of stories. It tells the journey right from the beginning, planning stages, all the way through to me crossing the finish line in Athens. And so hopefully people will enjoy it.
I'm sure they will. Nick, thank you again for your time. Much appreciated.
Thank you. Take care.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
So that brings us to the end of this week's Runner's World podcast. A big thanks to our guest, Nick Butter, and to you, of course, for listening.
You can still subscribe to Runner's World magazine and get 3 issues for only £5.
Please visit.
What a deal. Please visit hearstmagazines.co.uk/runnersworldpodcast to get this exclusive listener offer. The Runner's World podcast is available on Acast, iTunes and all of your favourite podcast apps. Just search Runner's World UK and remember to subscribe. Thank you for listening. We will see you next week.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.